One of the first things we learn about evolution is that it takes time. Your parents' parents and your kids' kids won't look that different. Creatures just don't change very quickly, or at least not fast enough for us to perceive, in most cases, that is. A recent study points out that certain changes in environment can change species more quickly than we thought. The study focused on the Alaska earthquake of 1964 and a fish called the stickleback. It was a team of researchers from the University of Oregon involved with the study, including Susan Bassam, who's a biologist and senior research associate at the Institute of Ecology and Evolution at the U of O, and our guest on The Exchange. Susan, welcome.
Good morning.
Let's talk about the stickleback itself first. It sounds like a very adaptable fish in many circumstances. Give us a little sketch of it.
It is. It's a species that's very widespread in the northern hemisphere, in coastal areas and in the sea, ponds, rivers. And I guarantee there's a lot of stickleback in your listening area. They exist all around Europe and, of course, along our coastline here, extending as far south as Baja, I believe, is the furthest south population identified. And they have invaded from the sea into freshwater systems countless times over their 10 to 18 million year history. So they're similar to salmon in that some of them are anadromous. They go into freshwater systems to breed, and then as juveniles, they come back out again into the sea.
This sounds like a real all-purpose fish, capable of living just about anywhere.
It's true. We've even found them at pretty high elevation here in central Oregon in a caldera lake. Probably the highest population that's been described.
And Susan, you were part of a 2010 study and publication about stickleback and evolution. Give us an idea what that was about.
Yeah, so one of the very interesting facts about them is that because of this high number of invasions into freshwater systems, they've had many, many chances to evolve new forms. And this has led to replicate parallel natural experiments in evolution and adaptation to freshwater. And one of the things that people have noticed is that when they're in the sea, they tend to be fairly large for a stickleback, 2 to 3 inches, and very silvery, and they're covered in armor. The name gastrosteus means bony belly because they're covered in these plates of bone. And they have large spines on their pelvic region that are defensive structures. They get into fresh water, and over tens of thousands of years, some of these lakes now contain fish that are much smaller. They have different coloration. They've lost a lot of their armor. They have lost these spines. They've changed the shape of their heads, their feeding structures, their swimming structures. In short, they're quite a bit different from their ancestors over just a few tens of thousands of years. We thought that was already pretty fast evolution. But now we've done this analysis showing that even in 50 years, which represents something like 25 to 50 generations, they can undergo many of these same adaptations to fresh water. In the 2010 study, we did fine-scale genetic analysis showing how many regions in the genome have changed when you compare the marine ancestor to several of these freshwater independently evolved populations.
Which raises a question that set my mind spinning in a couple different directions when I was getting ready to talk to you, which is, I mean, do physical changes happen first and then genes adapt, or do genes make the changes and then the physical changes show up?
Yeah, we'd like to get at that. We think that many of these genomic regions that we detect are already adapted to freshwater, but they're present in very, very low levels in the sea, in the ocean populations, and they're scattered. So a single fish will not have all of these adapted regions in the genome. He might carry one, or she might carry two. And so those basically have disintegrated in the sea into separate fish, but when fish invade from the sea, if enough of them invade, you can basically scrap back together the genome of a freshwater-adapted fish. Does that make sense?
It does. So the pieces are there, but just not useful in the ocean-going fish, and then when they go inland to a freshwater area, they those parts of the genome assert themselves?
Well, we don't know how much they remain cryptic in the sea, not expressed. That's also a possibility, or it could just be the genomic context in which they are is mostly marine genome, and so they're not they're selected against, for one thing, if they were expressed, but also they may just not behave the same way in a mostly marine genome.
Hmm. Susan Bassam's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a biologist at the University of Oregon and a senior research associate in the Institute of Ecology and Evolution. We're talking about stickleback, small fish that apparently are quite adaptable to both salt and fresh water, and some findings in a study recently published with researchers from the University of Oregon involved. Join us on the Exchange with your questions and comments, 800-838-3760 on the phone and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what were you looking at in the study you just published a little bit ago?
Yeah, so you might remember in 1964, there was a massive earthquake in Alaska,
which led to a big tsunami in Crescent City, among other places.
That's right. Most people didn't die in the earthquake itself. Only about 130 people died, actually, but most of them died in the resulting tsunamis. And it was massive. It was a 9.2 on the scale, and the San Francisco earthquake that was so devastating in 1989 was only a 6.9. So this one released something, I don't know, several thousand times the amount of energy was released in this Alaskan quake. And tsunami waves were measured as far away as Peru and Antarctica and New Zealand.
Wow.
Fortunately, there just weren't very many people living around there, so not many people died. But what happened was the Pacific plate that's been sliding and still is sliding underneath the North American plate at a rate of about 2 inches a year was stuck, held up, and tension hadn't been released in centuries. And suddenly it released and the whole plate slid something like 30 feet. And that created a huge drop onshore around Anchorage, for example, and then the whole plate lifted out at sea in the Prince William Sound in the Gulf of Alaska. Some places lifted up as much as 30 feet. And there were already marine islands out there, but the marine islands then grew in real estate because what had been seafloor now was lifted above sea level. And over time, that could accumulate silt, for example, and do more land building. And little freshwater ponds that hadn't existed there before appeared over time. And fish from the sea, we think, invaded these ponds that hadn't existed before. And during the span it took between when the earthquake happened and when we collected those fish, they changed in many of the ways that I outlined. They became much smaller. In fact, they look quite a bit like mainland populations of freshwater stickleback that are tens of thousands of years old.
When you say invaded, I want to zero in on that term a little bit, because so did they actually travel, or were they just trapped in the ponds when the land rose and shut them off from the sea?
It could be that in some places they were actually trapped during the uplift, but what is more likely is that these low-lying ponds accumulated freshwater over time and got cut off gradually by insiltation, and Alaska has some pretty big storms, and we think that probably in some places marine fish can still get into some of these ponds, because we find in some of the populations we studied little freshwater-adapted stickleback and also big ocean-going stickleback. So it's still happening that there could be migration in or sporadic, you know, ingress of marine fish into some of these ponds. Nonetheless, the natural selection there is so strong for this kind of freshwater adaptation that even with big influx of a bunch of genes from the sea, these freshwater fish are still able to maintain their shape.
So, over how much time then? I mean, we're talking a total of 50 years or 51, I guess, since between the earthquake and the publication of the study results. But how quickly, you know, how many generations, how many years are you noticing differences?
Right. So it's probably less than 50. One of the islands that we looked at is a little rock of an island called Danger Island. And very dramatic. Our colleagues that collected there had to be helicoptered in because it's too unsafe to land by boat. And there's one pond that had stickleback in it there. And they basically look like marine stickleback. They're big, they're silvery. However, we can already detect that they have a genetic difference from their neighbors in the sea. And the reason I say already is that we think probably that is so exposed, that habitat, that they probably get inundated and flushed out periodically by storm surges and big high tides during storm surges. So that population maybe has been reset multiple times since the earthquake.
With new populations from the sea coming in?
Yeah, just wiped out, you know, any adaptation that had started to become noticeable there has been flushed.
So give us a sense again, Susan, about how profound the differences are between the freshwater pond version and the ocean version of the stickleback.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, maybe they all look the same to us as, you know, just lay people, but in human terms, like it'd be like you dropped a bunch of humans onto an island and, you know, 400, 800 years later, after a number of generations, you come back, maybe you've allowed a few more people to trickle in from time to time, and the people living there are three-quarters the height of the people that you landed. They have really short legs. They don't have as many teeth. They have little eyes. that kind of thing. There's pretty striking differences in terms of the function of the fish. So they're adapted to, they're physiologically adapted to deal with different ions, for example, salt concentration. And they've changed a lot of their feeding and swimming characteristics.
Wow, that's still remarkable stuff we're talking about here. Susan Bassam is a University of Oregon biologist, a senior research associate in the Institute of Ecology and Evolution. We're talking about essentially evolution by earthquake, how the 1964 Alaska earthquake made changes in populations, fresh and saltwater, of the stickleback. I think in this case, the three-spine stickleback, is it?
That's right.
Okay. You can join us on the exchange if you have questions or comments about this evolutionary acceleration. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Given the what appears to be the eminent adaptability of the stickleback, though, Susan, I mean, is this anything that is it good to know that this can happen, but is it something that's limited to the likes of the stickleback?
I don't believe so. I mean, there are many species that exist in alternate habitats or multiple habitats, and that adaptation to multiple habitats can cause selection to operate differently in those different places, such that you maintain genetic diversity. And genetic diversity is what we draw upon when we've bred different kinds of crops or different breeds of dogs. A lot of that diversity already existed in wolves, but we just put it together in different genomic context. A very rarefied genomic context in order to get these funny-looking wolves. Granted, there have been new mutations as well. So what we think is going on in the stickleback is their very long history of invading freshwater has led to the accumulation of ancient mutations that were beneficial for freshwater invasion being maintained in basically the stickleback version of the wolf population in the sea. So, you know, instead of a gene pool, it's sort of like the sea of genes out there.
Uh-huh.
And there's probably other examples I could give you, like humans, for example. Also, we know inhabit different alternate environments. There are people who've invaded, if you will, high elevation in Tibet and Ethiopia and Andes in South America, and they have adapted over time to those high elevations in a genetic way, not just, you know, you go to high altitude and you feel sick for a while and then you grow more red blood cells and then you feel a little bit better. These people are living somewhere around the top of Mount Hood, if you can imagine, over 12,000 feet and higher.
Which is tricky conditions on a good day, yeah.
Very, very difficult for humans because the oxygen levels are, you know, something like 60% of what we down here in the lowlands experience. And just now, though, science is starting to put together the genetic basis of some of these adaptations. It's kind of hard to show in humans that selection has been operating on them. So we're just getting at those underpinnings now. But if we can do it in humans, we can do it in many other species and study this phenomenon. We think that standing genetic variation, as we call it, which is this vast pool of genetic different isoforms of different genes. We call them alleles. They're called, you have one allele, I have a different allele, but we have the same genes. That resource is very ancient, potentially. We don't have to wait for new mutations in order to adapt.
Huh. Let's take some calls. We have Mike in Eagle Point on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Susan Bassam.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Anchorage is my hometown. I was 17 at the time of the earthquake. One thing that I've noticed in the Susitna Valley, just north of Anchorage, is a lack of sticklebacks in areas that were low-lying lakes that had quite a population of sticklebacks previously. And I've attributed that to the invasion of Great Northern Pike into the Susitna River system, and I'm wondering whether the pike have also had an influence on the evolutionary adaptation.
Okay, good question. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, I don't know exactly when pike were introduced, but that's definitely true that the pike is wiping out many of these unique, older, post-glacial populations, and climate change is doing a little bit in that regard as well, in terms of drying up some of these ponds that have these interesting natural experiments in them. Some of the ponds are very small and very shallow, and they're disappearing. But certainly some of the adaptations that we see in freshwater stickleback are a response to different predator regimes. Some ponds have piscine predators, big fish, that eat them. Some ponds have more predation from aquatic insect larvae, which eat very differently. So if you're a fish, you are going to swallow a stickleback whole, pretty much. So the stickleback has two big spines on the pelvis and stickles on the back. And when you look at them head on, they can make themselves look like a big tripod, and they're very hard to swallow. They become much more difficult to handle for a fish that has a limited size of its mouth. On the other hand, if there's a lot of aquatic insect larvae in there from predatory insects like dragonflies, they basically are able to use the stickles and the spines to grab the fish and just munch on it, like eating corn on the cob. So in those ponds that have a lot of insect predators, they tend to lose their pelvic spines.
Wow, it sounds like they're trying to swallow a star thistle whole, but boy, the nature red in tooth and claw always, but fascinating look at how fast evolution can happen given the circumstances. Susan Bassam is a biologist at the University of Oregon who joined us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Susan, thank you.
You're welcome.